I'm your chair for today. My name's Caroline Bennett, and I'm pleased to introduce our presenter for this morning, John Moroney. John is going to speak to us around the Global Insurance Capital Standards, and I guess it is the authoritative version on the topic, direct from Basel, so fantastic for us to be able to hear John speak today. Just to introduce John for those who don't know him, John is the Head of Capital and Solvency at the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. Previously, he was appointed Head of Financial Stability and a member of the management team in 2013 after joining the IAIS Secretariat in 2009. His responsibilities include management of the Capital and Solvency team and chairing the Capital Development Working Group. John is the co-vice chair of the Enterprise and Financial Risk Committee of the International Actuarial Association and manages the relationship between the IAA and the IAIS, which is quite a mouthful. So look forward to hearing what John has to share with us. He's going to speak for about 30 minutes and then we'll have the opportunity for questions after that, so please do get ready with your questions. Just a reminder ahead of that, obviously when you're ready to ask your questions after John has finished presenting, the microphone is in the middle of the room, but I will remind you of that again before you get the chance. So thanks, John.
Thanks very much, Carolyn, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's always a pleasure to come back to Melbourne. It's been a few years since I was here last time, so nice to see some familiar faces in the audience and also some unfamiliar ones, which is showing again the growing diversity of the profession. And I'll especially welcome Rob Curtis to back up. Rob and I did a fair bit of work in this area a few years ago when he was chairing one of the IAS committees. And I think there's a number of faces that were at Rob's session yesterday. So that's very helpful because there was a little bit of overlap in our slides, and that'll enable me to accelerate through some of those to not repeat too much of what Rob says. But if there's any need to clarify that, let me know. So this is the areas I'm planning to cover today. Most of it's on the work we're doing on the Global Insurance Capital Standard, the ICS, but there are a few other acronyms there that I'll explain briefly on the way through. Context, I think everyone in this room is pretty familiar with the global financial crisis. If you add up the trillions of dollars of impact in loss of economic growth, in direct and indirect bailouts, government guarantees, it was pretty traumatic. Most of it centred around the banking side, but the insurance sector was not immune. I've just listed a few of those that were either affected or contributed to some of the dramas back in 2008-2009. There's a new group that was set up shortly thereafter, the Financial Stability Board, which is coordinating things at the global level, including such things as the G-SIFIs, the Global Systemically Important Financial Institutions. The IAS has been around for 20 years. Our role is basically going to be touched on in the next slide, but since the global crisis, we've done a major review of all the standards and we're building a lot more of those, which I will come to. As I said, we are a global insurance standard setter. We are have a mission of contributing to global financial stability. That comes up quite a lot in our discussions around the world with stakeholders as to what's the balance between policyholder protection and financial stability. We don't see that as a major conflict or trade-off. Having a more stable financial system is definitely a good way of protecting policyholders because the downside of instability is pretty visible. We also are involved in a range of implementation activities, regional capacity building, educational arrangements. And we promote supervisory cooperation through a range of mechanisms. Again, I'll just quickly flick past these acronyms. I think most of you are probably familiar with some or all of those that I'll cover, I'll mention them briefly each time they come up. So this is the architecture of what we do. If I can sort of point around here, there's three levels. And we've had insurance core principles since probably 15 years plus. They get reviewed regularly. We're going through another review process of those at the moment to make sure by the time we get to 2018 we have a modern, sophisticated, up-to-date foundation for ComFrame, which is our second tier, which is a framework for supervision of internationally active insurance groups. IAIGs, they get called, in another difficult to pronounce acronym. And the third tier is a restricted tier. There's nine global systemically important insurers, some of which are represented in the room, which is always good to see. And they have a special package of measures that include enhanced supervision, higher capital levels, and better resolution arrangements. And we try to apply all of those different packages in a consistent fashion across the mixture of legal entities, groups, internationally active, and the GSI. So it's an interesting mixture and challenge. As I've mentioned, the GSIs in 2013 were the proud recipients of more attention from their supervisors, both at the global level and at the national level. The HLA, high loss absorbency, is one of those one leg of the supervisory stool. In fact, I should have mentioned my colleague Jules Gribble, who's back in Basel doing lots of serious work on the HLA consultation document due out next month. He was quite involved in preparing these slides, would have loved to have been here in his hometown of Melbourne, but sends his regards to everybody, but couldn't be in two places at once. So the intent is we look for consistency with the banking sector where appropriate, but we're very much looking at insurance-focused and insurance-centric solutions to what we're doing, but quite often there's a debate about getting the balance right between those two aspects. Again, just looking at the timeline, the focus last year was on BCR, basic capital requirement, which we delivered on schedule to the FSB and the G20 in time for Tony Abbott to receive it in Brisbane when Australia was G20 president last year. This year we're working very hard on the HLA for the GSIs, and we're also working on the insurance capital standard. There's the same group of people working on all three of these. I'll talk a little bit about logistics shortly, but the plan is to have the first version of ICS ready by the end of next year, which is quite a challenging time schedule we're working towards. And this fleshes out a bit more of the time frame. There's a lot of field testing going on. We collect information. The launch of that happened last month with follow-up sessions in Tokyo last week, in New York the week before. And this will be an annual exercise to give us very much an evidence-based empirical foundation for us to make the policy calls on. So the plan is we'll adopt a second version of ICS by the end of 2018, and that will be rolled out from 2019. That won't be the end of the story, but that's as far as the time frame that we're looking at the moment. Now, turning to the members involved, I've got a group of seven staff in Basel that form the engine room. Of that seven, there's three Australians, two Canadians, one from Korea, one from Singapore, one from China, and one from France. So that adds up to more than seven, so I think that's right, we're recruiting at the moment. So that's a fairly small team for the work that needs to be done. So we have a larger group of volunteer members from around probably 20 jurisdictions now, and over 30 people get together somewhere in the world each month for about a week. So last week it was in Tokyo, so we had 30-something people up in Tokyo for the week. Some of us spent the prior week in New York having interactions with US stakeholders that are very interested in what we're doing. And so we also had a chance to have bilateral meetings with each of the three US GSIs, MetLife, AIG and Prudential Financial. And we also had a meeting with all the nine GSIs. They tend to follow us around the world. They can be regarded as some of our loyalist fans, in terms of we've had face-to-face meetings with the nine of them every month, I think for the last 5 or 6 months. Most months is an excuse for them to be in the same part of the world as we are. And we draw particularly the members most active. When I pulled this slide together, it probably should have evolved a bit, but the main ones are shown there, Europeans summarised by a few of their members. Most of the European authorities are members of EIOPA, the European Insurance and Occupational Pensions Authority, but we also have Finnmark. While Switzerland is part of Europe geographically, it's not part of the European Union arrangement, so they've got strong interest in what we do. The Bank of England, one of our integrated regulators, And one of our newest members over in the US is the Federal Reserve Board. They joined as a member less than 2 years ago. They now have regulatory responsibility for about 40% of the life insurance market in the US, in conjunction with the state regulators at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And there's also involvement from US Treasury through the Federal Insurance Office. So we've got a lot of interest in the US. That's still the largest insurance market in the world. So they're very interested in what we're doing. And that's why we spent a week on the way here. So I think if there's a prize from the Institute for Furthest Travelling, I'm still on my trip that started in Basel 2 weeks ago, had the week in New York, the week in Tokyo, and I get to redo this in Brisbane on Friday and a few in Sydney next week. But the US is very interested. Just before we arrived, the US Congress had two hearings into the development of capital standards, and in particular the role that the IAS is performing there. Some of their insurers and some of their supervisors are a little bit nervous about the shift from state to national to global standards and regulations. So I don't think the Australian Parliament has spent as much time sort of looking at insurance issues in my career as what the US Congress has done in the last year or so. So if you're interested in this sort of thing, there's some good webcasts you can see there and a very good testimony from some of our members, including Mark van der Weet from the Federal Reserve. He's a deputy director there and gets involved both directly and indirectly in our discussions, deliberations. And just to mention some of his testimony to set the scene, global standard setting is not new to the Federal Reserve, as we have for decades participated in standard setting for global banks through our membership in the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. As a general proposition, we believe in the utility of having effective global standards for regulation and supervision of internationally active financial firms. When implemented consistently across jurisdictions, such standards help provide a level playing field for a global financial institutions. Further, consistent global financial regulatory standards can help limit regulatory arbitrage and jurisdiction shopping and can promote financial stability. We recognise, of course, that international regulatory standards cannot be imposed on US firms by an international body. Rather, these standards apply in the United States only if adopted by the appropriate US regulators in accordance with applicable rulemaking procedures conducted in the US. So that's the same in every jurisdiction. We are an advisory body at the IAS. We have no force of law. So we get a group of people together and come up with standards that we hope, and our members indicate they plan to adopt those, but it's up to each country to decide how and when to do. BCR, Rob covered this pretty well yesterday, so I won't say a lot more about that other than it's in place. It is done on a market-adjusted valuation. It's factor-based, which means it's not that risk-sensitive. It has got some reflections of risk. The plan is to refine and improve that over time. So we're getting confidential reporting on that from 35 firms later this year, and we will look at that over the next few years. Again, the picture probably shows a little bit more interest in the labels. We, through a process of supervisory judgment and field testing, looking at different jurisdictions, we came up with a set of 15 factors that we thought were suitable. We've had general support for those. There's still a little bit of debate going on about the shape of it overall, but I think that was a good example of what can be done in a fairly short time frame, and has set the basis of that's the first global quantitative insurance capital standard or measure. And that's how it sort of gets allocated across the different risk areas. So asset-related risk is just over 50%, and the other components are fairly evenly split between traditional life, traditional non-life, and the NTNI, non-traditional non-insurance activities. So the market-adjusted valuation approach is something that has similarities to systems in Europe, Australia, South Africa, Canada, Chinese systems, not just Solvency II. Sometimes people think that we're overly influenced by Solvency II. As I said, we have members working on this from all different parts of the world. I think most of you are familiar with the Australian system, so I won't go through the details on what's there. Particular interest in the discount rate framework, so I've got a few slides on what we're doing this year. So we've changed the approach from last year's field testing. We've now got a three-segment approach that starts with the more market-consistent view of the world, where there are deep and liquid markets. We're looking at 35 different jurisdictions and deriving yield curves for those. In the long term, we've got a mechanism which is summarised here based on OECD analysis and research of what would be suitable long-term forward rates for yield curves, and then we blend the two. Just showing as an example what this looks like for Europe at the bottom, US in the middle, and China on the top. So that's going from 1 year out to 88 years. So there's quite a degree of interest in how these will impact on both the calculations directly on valuation, but also on the stresses being applied. On the HLA, that's the most urgent thing this year. It's designed to reduce the probability of distress or failure, and thus the expected impact of any failures. We will hopefully issue a consultation document by the end of next month. We need to go through our finalisation over the next couple of weeks and then put it through approval of our committees and the Financial Stability Board committees. And the plan is that that will be the basis, or the BCR will be the basis of HLA until the insurance capital standard is ready sometime after 2019. There's 10 principles. They've been up on our website since last September. I won't go through those in detail now, given the timing. As I said, field testing is crucial to help us develop all these capital standards. We've got over 35 internationally active groups involved in field testing, including all nine GSIs. There's a lot of work in getting this done. It's a major and very interesting and challenging research project, effectively. What we're aiming with the ICS ultimately, and this means after 2019, not by 2019, is to have a single ICS which will include a common methodology by which one ICS achieves comparable outcomes across jurisdictions, and we mean by that substantially the same outcomes across jurisdictions. And at the moment, it's very different outcomes in jurisdictions, so that's quite a challenge. So we plan for the ongoing work to lead to improved convergence over time on the key elements of the ICS working towards that ultimate goal. So this will be an ongoing interactive process that's very much driven over the next few years by field testing, and after that by the process of global standard convergence, which is not necessarily well defined yet in the insurance sector, but we're hoping that will become more so. So the focus is very much on valuation, capital resources, capital requirements, and I'll come to each of those shortly. The context is straight from the consultation document. It's basically that our members have said they intend to implement this as a minimum standard. Exactly how that will be implemented depends on what is developed. So there's still quite a bit of debate to have about there'll be a standard method, there'll be potential for other methods, including internal models, and how the different valuation systems will be taken into account will be looked at very closely this year and next year. This is, again, just putting in context. The main focus will be an ICS ratio looking at what capital resources qualify for being regarded as acceptable to the supervisors, and do they exceed the amount of capital requirement that's defined. On the capital resources, we're generally pursuing the path of a tiered approach. There's a lot of resistance from industry in many parts of the world, particularly those that don't yet have tiering of capital resources systems. In places like Australia, I think this is fairly familiar. We'll split it into two, the highest quality in Tier 1, most of which is likely not to have a limit, but there is plan to be limits. We haven't specified them yet. And Tier 2, lower quality, where there's things like subordinated debt timeframes and a mixture of paid up. And then there's a whole range of issues and questions we'll look at there about the purpose, risk coverage, whether we pitch it at 99.5% of VAR or somewhere else. We'll be testing the 99.5% this year directly, doing some indirect testing of other measures, and we'll do some more testing next year. We're looking at a range of deterministic and stochastic approaches, including some stochastic modelling, some stress-based arrangements, summarised on this next slide, which Rob had a very similar one there, so I'll skip over this one fairly quickly, other than to say that the stress approach to most of the life insurance risks, factor-based probably for most of the non-life risks, modelling on the catastrophe side. So we've got teams working on all these different areas. This hasn't been published yet, but will be shortly, in terms of the proposal is to map all of the non-life risks on the premium risk side into 8 categories, where factors would apply to the greater of net earned premium or expected premium to be earned, factors ranging from 15% up to 70. And on the claims reserve, factors applying to the net current estimates between 10 and 50%. And there's a mapping exercise that's been conducted by all the supervisors that's out with the volunteers at the moment. So there'll be more detail on this later this year. In terms of looking at the risk aggregation diversification, we're probably going to go down at least a two-step aggregation approach seems to be most manageable. This is how it looks in terms of for the premium and reserve risk on the non-life side. Again, partly driven by the existing arrangements in some jurisdictions, partly by supervisory judgment, and we're expecting a lot of interest in this in the field testing exercise to just see how it works in practice. And on aggregation of a catastrophe risk, that's probably a fairly standard formula for most in this room. Some of the groups we've talked to in the last couple of weeks have probably had less familiarity with it, but again, we'll be getting this tested for different catastrophe arrangements. And we'll be collecting data about natural catastrophes, how that applies in different regions. We experienced a typhoon when we were in Tokyo last week. Wasn't too exciting, but they said they rarely get typhoons at that time of year. And then we had a few minor earthquakes, just to remind us that for Tokyo they're fairly common. I think tremors rather than quakes, but it certainly reminded us that there's much of the world that is vulnerable to different sorts of potential catastrophes. And this shows the planned aggregation approach between the life risks, the market risks, and pulling together the overall sort of global mixture. So again, that is all these things at this stage are for testing only. This isn't necessarily or isn't even likely to be the end result once we get to the end of next year. But the plan is we want to test something as specifically as possible. So in effect, we have published version 0.1 of what the ICS could look like based on illustrative factors in the field testing specifications. They amount to about 250 pages and about a similar length of data collection template. The plan is to make those documents public once we do some refinement based on feedback received this month. So the plan is to have that material out in the public arena sometime next month or as soon after that as we can do so. So if you're interested in this, the detail will be available shortly. Turning specifically to the valuation issues, we tried to get agreement on a single valuation approach last year, but our members are used to different valuation approach in different jurisdictions, and they've decided they want us to look at multiple valuation approaches at least this year and next year. So we are using the market-adjusted valuation approach to develop the example of a standard method, but we're also collecting data on various gap valuation approaches from different jurisdictions to better understand the differences between approaches in US, Japan, Canada and some other places. The rationale for this is some members feel strongly that they want to keep using the systems that they're familiar with, that they've got a strong auditing basis, strong use of existing systems, some hesitance to move from deterministic to stochastic basis of reserving at this stage. And if the accounting bodies had managed to get more convergence over the past 20 years, there'd perhaps be more sort of confidence in moving to a single valuation approach. But the absence of converged accounting standards is certainly slowing down the comfort of moving on to a single valuation approach for capital standards in our audiences. I won't go through too much of detail here because timing is getting away from me, but we're still developing just how this could work. So we've got groups of people in US and elsewhere working both domestically and on a global sharing basis as to what sort of adjustments would make sense. Perhaps the examples over the next couple of slides will show sort of more in the US. It's not just US GAAP. There's also US statutory accounting that applies to the mutual sector, and they've had a specific law passed that forbids the Federal Reserve Board from requiring to do GAAP reporting. So the Federal Reserve Board is obliged by law to pick up the statutory accounting for any of the firms it supervises, particularly mutuals that only do statutory reporting. And the there's quite a bit of this in the field testing information, and we're trying to get enough understanding through how adjustments to insurance liabilities could work. Things like the US has a system of loss recognition testing. How can we build that into the arrangement? Japan has cash flow testing. There's an asset valuation model in Canada. So we're looking at how can we combine these different approaches which the local jurisdictions are very comfortable with, and similarly with adjustments on the asset side and adjustments for deferred acquisition costs and value of business acquired. So there's a range of things that we're looking at, just how material are these, what are the drivers of the differences, and can we still build a meaningful comparable system around the different valuation approaches. Some people think that's very challenging. We are waiting to see the data before we form a view of how challenging. So the particular things we're looking at collecting information on from the balance sheet, a reconciliation of the insurance liabilities from the different GAAP approaches to the market-adjusted approach, and we're looking at testing capital charges on a range of a subset of the risks in the GAAP with adjustments area, mainly on the basis of the scope of the work and our availability of resources, which is very much stretched to deal with all the different areas of interest. And the US one has got a most advanced specification of how their preferred approach to valuation could work. And this is a combination of work from the different supervisors, the Fed, the US Treasury, the states, and also a lot of interaction with US industry in terms of how we could pick up what the US is already doing, has done for many decades, and feed that into the global insurance capital standard. And that just shows a little bit more detail about the specifics of the sorts of reconciliation that we're aiming on doing. Key things are getting updates on current assumptions, because a lot of locked-in assumptions are used in the US GAAP reports, eliminations of additional margins, trying to get more consistency in contract boundaries, and collect other information will help us better understand the differences. And that leads us to these questions about whether it is going to be possible to reconcile the different valuation approaches within the aim of having a globally consistent, comparable valuation approach. We think it is going to take several years of working through this. We think essentially it's an empirical question, and so we're not going to give an answer perhaps this year. We'll hopefully better understand it this year, and we need to give an answer to it next year when we come up with the first version of ICS by the end of next year. And it's a lofty goal. We think it's a worthwhile one. There's a joint effort of many of our members, industry participants, volunteers, and others. So that's the big question, or one of the big questions facing us, and happy to see what questions there might be from the audience. Thank you, Carolyn.
So just to remind everyone, if you do have a question for John, the microphone is in the middle of the room. Otherwise, I need to leap down and start handing this around. So we'll start first with the microphone in the middle of the room. If you can please say who you are before you ask your question. Also, a quick reminder that you also have to do your feedback form, just giving you another minute to think of your brilliant question. That is able to be done on your smartphone or tablet. So who would like to be our first question? Otherwise, I have a couple, but I wanted to give everyone their chance. I think we've got one coming. Jeff, you'll be next.
Francis Burgess. Thank you very much for the presentation. I really enjoyed it. Just one question. I was thinking through and listening to the presentation. It seems like some countries are going to be quite developed in their prudential standards and have a lot more sophisticated ones, while other countries are obviously going to be more simplistic and lagging behind. How is it possible to get that convergence? Because essentially the people are already sort of there already. We're going to have to slow down to wait to catch up. So is it possible to ever get that, or do you have the buy-in from the people who be in a bit more sophisticated position to sort of hold off developing further sophistication while the rest of the world sort of catches up with potentially where the more developed states might be?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that question. It's one that's certainly occupied our minds for several years because the debate about whether this exercise is worthwhile was underway before I arrived in 2009 in Basel. It accelerated up until 2013 when the decision was made that it really is a worthwhile effort. The timing was partly driven by our original proposal for high loss absorbency for the GSIs. The Financial Stability Board was to use local capital requirements, and they rejected that proposal on the basis of the lack of comparability of those local capital requirements. So they said, you know, we need to develop some global requirements at least for the GSIs, but our members felt it was worthwhile, and the FSB agreed that if we're serious about overall financial stability and more consistency in policyholder protection, it is worthwhile having a global standard for at least the internationally active insurance group. So the question has has led to a lot of time being spent sort of up until now. There's still different views around the supervisory world, and we will keep sort of revisiting just how ambitious can we want to achieve. But the plan is this would be a standard. The more advanced and developed jurisdictions may have relatively little to do to actually meet it. Those that haven't upgraded their systems for 10 or 20 years are going to have a lot more to do, but we'll have to just wait and see where the design gets concluded.
I'm Jeff Atkins. John, have you given up on IFRS for valuation?
We haven't, but we're building a system that isn't reliant on IFRS actually succeeding and being implemented around the world. So there's a lot of consistency between the IFRS building blocks approach and what we're doing. So we don't think there's going to be any real surprises if things go ahead smoothly, but particularly the willingness of those jurisdictions that haven't embraced IFRS and may be unlikely to do so for the next 10 or 20 years, we don't think we can wait for that. So we'll try to leverage it as much as we can, and if there's more convergence between ISB and FASB, then that'll be great, but we're sort of working ahead assuming that we can't actually afford to wait for that to come
Fickle.
Together.
And to what extent do you expect the moderately complex material you outlined there on the BCR to filter down to the local entity standards?
There seems to be quite a deal of interest in BCR beyond its design purpose, and I think that's one of the power of any global standard is people take notice of it because it has been set up by a group of global supervisors and hence has...
You were going to say experts, weren't you, mate?
Global experts, including supervisors. But it's interesting to see. It isn't designed to be rolled out in 50 jurisdictions around the world to deal with local issues, but the shape and structure would probably lend itself. I know the World Bank has expressed some interest in there, and I expect to see things that you can trace back to the basic capital requirement design turning up in areas over the next 5 or 10 years because it actually suits them basing something locally on something global.
Other questions from the audience? I guess, John, just in terms of what you set out, and obviously it is both complex and politically challenging, where do you see the biggest risks to actually achieving what you've talked to us about today?
In several areas. The main one is probably the ability to get buy-in from all the supervisors and stakeholders as we get closer to the points of saying this is what the finished product is likely to look like. At the moment, it is a research project. We're gathering information, we're gathering ideas. Nothing is really yet fixed, and so people, I think, are more willing to go along the journey not knowing exactly the destination. I think once the destination becomes clearer, it probably moves away from the technical end of the spectrum to the more political end. Do people like what is coming out of there? And that's always a challenge in a global environment. You're dealing with, we've got members from 140 countries. In the US, we have 56 members from states, territories, the federal level. So trying to get an agreement across technical areas that do have lots of implications is challenging, and just the ability to keep the resourcing up. We're on a tight schedule, so it was very challenging to deliver the launch of the field testing at the end of April. We had people, members, staff working silly hours and days. I know actuaries are used to that and love and thrive on that, but there is a risk that if we bite off more than we can chew, we'll not deliver good quality material on the time frame that we've mapped out. But we are taking on more staff, we are getting more members involved, and we had meetings in the New York Fed in New York 2 weeks ago, and we had almost 200 stakeholders in the room for the day. Another lot on the phone. There's certainly lots of interest in what we're doing, and lots of, we are getting very good input from various sources, industry, the International Actuarial Association's involved and regularly gives input, from firms, we're trying to get more involvement from academics that are interested in these areas. So it's a big challenging task, but we keep looking for more and more help, and that's one of the reasons I'm here. We certainly are keen to share what we're doing in as many forums around the world to get buy-in, and while Australia is only a relatively small fraction of the world's insurance market, I think it has got one of the more interesting markets that has tested and tried different aspects, and so I would encourage those interested in Australia not to be put off by the tyranny of distance, and please send us your good ideas each time we call for them or on an unsolicited basis.
Another opportunity for anyone to jump up and ask a question before I continue on with my questions for the day. Everyone's looking a little frightened. So I'll ask, a question which you may not be able to answer, but if you had a crystal ball, and this obviously came up a bit in the session yesterday as well, you don't know yet where the proposed path will land in terms of the probability of sufficiency. Mm-hmm. Where are you thinking about where that might land? It obviously has very big implications in different countries and so forth, but it's a...
Yeah, it's, again, a very good question, and one that we know we'll have to turn our minds to next year. This year we're gathering information to help design what next year's field testing will be, and that will need to firm up as, do we go with a 99.5% VAR, which has been selected by a number of our members in recent years, or do we deliberately aim at somewhat below that to clearly say that this is a minimum global standard and not everyone is at or above the 99.5% level, so it would make sense for a global standard to be set somewhat lower than that to just make that process of getting buy-in more manageable, but that would then raise issues of comparability with other sectors, and Rob went through a good discussion yesterday about how the investment grade thinking has sort of been a key sort of a benchmark in early years. So I think there will be on part of the discussion where does it compare with that, because that is used. But there is still interest in looking at a tail VAR sort of approach and looking at it longer term than a 1 year time frame, and I think that discussion will stay alive for at least a year or two, but I can't be any more definitive, because we really seriously want to get the information back from the field testing and use that to firm up our views as to what makes sense.
You talked about consistency with other, industry sectors. Can you talk a little bit about how you work with other bodies in that regard?
I can. So we are in Basel, hosted by the Bank for International Settlement. They also host the Basel Committee for Banking Supervision. They host the Financial Stability Board and a number of other groups that are involved in either monitoring of the different parts of the global financial sector or standing setting in that. So we have relative easy proximity and cooperation. There's a process called the Basel process, which is effectively the synergy from having all these different groups co-located in one place. And so every day I'll be seeing people from the Basel Committee, informally or formally, and from the Financial Stability Board. We'll invite them to our meetings where we think they have a useful contribution to make. We'll get them along and make presentations when we want to understand just the implications of what they're doing, particularly once we look at non-insurance areas. So the BCR specifically picks up existing sector requirements in the banking sector, applies those to the unregulated banking sector, picking up things in the assets under management that, you know, comes from work from the Basel Committee. So that makes sense to us in terms of both from a regulatory arbitrage point of view, and quite a lot of our members are central banks now and banking supervisors. So to propose something on credit risk that is different, where you may expect a identical or similar answer on the banking side, gets questioned quite seriously, because one line we hear often is, you know, does this corporate bond or government bond know that it's owned by an insurance company or a bank or a pension fund? You know, it's still the same bond, and if it's a corporate bond, there's a whole process there of attaching risk charges to it that differ in different parts of the world. But when we're looking at it, the answer is, well, why would we come up with a different answer for that if essentially the question does seem to be the same in not in all circumstances, but certainly in some of the ones that we take into account.
Okay, then just one last chance, as we've obviously said. Oh, here we go.
Hi, John.
Luke, I was almost disappointed that you weren't going to deliver on your promise.
We need something a little bit contentious. So, everyone, I'm Luke Seabury. I'm looking at the valuation standards, capital standards, and it all relies on the insurance companies giving you reliable and honest information. Mm-hmm. Now, in my way of thinking, a lot of when an insurance company goes broke, it could actually be the CEO or the CFO fiddling the books. Mm-hmm. So, and you might think, oh, well, we've got auditors to check that, but no, you pay your auditor. Mm-hmm. There could be a conflict of interest. Yep. I've got ratings agencies, but no, I pay the ratings agency to give, you know, to look at my company. So there's sort of a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. If a CEO or CFO wanted to fiddle their books, is having an increasingly complicated capital formula really relevant in the face of these human factors?
Very interesting question, and the ICS is one of the things we're doing. The development of ComFrame overall is looking at lots of the qualitative governance risk management issues. I spend a lot of my time when I go to IA meetings in my enterprise and financial risk committee looking at the softer side of what is challenging, not just in the insurance sector but other sectors. So I think it's just as important for supervisors to focus on issues of governance and issues of risk management and getting the companies to look at their own risk, which would include, I think their shareholders would be very interested in ensuring that the data that they're receiving in their financial statements and investor reports is telling the truth before they sort of endorse the remuneration and bonuses paid to chief executives and other senior sort of management. So supervisors aren't the only ones that are interested in the quality of the data underlying. Some jurisdictions, the US did a lot with a Sarbanes-Oxley sort of act post Enron, etc., to try to lift up the reliability of data. It's never going to be perfect. There's always going to be risks of fraud and malfeasance, etc. But the idea that you don't do something that's sensible on the metrics of looking at risk because someone might actually go and fraudulently report information, to my mind, isn't the connection I would make. I think we need to work on the hard areas of capital standards and doing calculations as scientifically as well we can, and we need to work on the soft side of trying to make sure we do have boards, chief executives, senior management, actuaries, auditors as fit to the task as possible where you can. As a number of the speakers at this morning's opening session were saying, the need to rebuild trust in the financial sector broadly, the insurance sector part of that, and I don't think we can ever stop working on all parts of it, but we think having a comparable global metric, so when you do have colleges of supervisors sitting down, they can spend their time much more efficiently thinking about what is the management doing with meaningful information, rather than having to spend an inordinate amount of time trying to compare and contrast all the different sorts of financial reports they get these days. So that's probably the best I can respond to at this stage.
chance for just one more question, if there's any more out there. Looks like a no, so we'll thank John for his presentation. Everyone wants to...
Thank you very much.